So at the top of our lesson, I wanted to give us an indication of kind of where we were at in Solomon's reign. I put on here 1 Kings 6 and 7 to give us an indication of the length of the time it took to build the temple, to build Solomon's palace, and to kind of give us an idea of where we're at today. So it says it took 7 years to build the temple, and it started in the fourth year of Solomon's reign. That's over in 1 Kings 6, 1. And then it goes through, and in the 1 Kings 6, 38, it says, so it was a 7 years building it, that being the temple. And then 7, 1 says, building his own house took 13 years. So we're through the palace, we're through the Solomon's palace being built, we're through the temple being built. You know that if he was 7 years building the temple, it was at least the 11th year of his reign when that was completed. It took him 13 years to build his palace. There aren't indications that the palace was started before or after the temple. So you at least know that 13 years into Solomon's reign that his palace was completed, maybe 17 years. And as we are entering this context, you see in 1 Kings 9, 10, it came about at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. So we are in this area, we're in the middle of Solomon's reign. And so he's finished with the temple. Israel had been given rest. God had protected them while they built the temple and the palace. And now we're into the reign of Solomon. You think about spending the time that he did building the temple, building his palace. That's kind of been a focal point for him. I mean, there's been a lot of other stuff going on, but that's been your main project. I can sympathize because, you know, sometimes you just hunker down and doing one thing. Study for 6 months to teach a class, you know, between the studying and the class. It's kind of been your main focus. Now, at least from what we've been shown, that's been the main focus of this storyline. Now we're going to open it up a little bit to what else has been going on in the kingdom. And then we're going to see God kind of reiterate some things. God's going to talk to Solomon again to remind him. He's been so focused here. Now that major project has been done, or those major projects are done, let's be mindful. So I asked the question, in 1 Kings 9, when did God first appear to Solomon, and what advice did he give Solomon? First Kings 3, 4, you said? 3:14. I've got 3:14. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there. I think it's 3, 4, and 5. Okay, sorry. All right. So in 1 Kings 3, and specifically, so verse 5, the Lord appeared to Solomon and asked, and he said, "Ask what you wish to give. Ask what you wish me to give to you." Solomon prays, and then keying in on what we'll find in our context. So down in verse 14. So Solomon asks for wisdom. God decides to give him more than wisdom. He gives him not only wisdom, but riches and honor as well. It says in verse 13, "So that there will not be any among the kings like you in all your days." Verse 14 is what we'll key in from this passage because it applies to 1 Kings 9. Verse 14 of 1 Kings 3, it says, "If you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days." All right, that's the advice that he has given Solomon. You know, to keep my commandments. He's not forcing him to do that. This is what his instructions are. I said advice, but this is his instructions to Solomon. How many times has this been told to Solomon? Just one. Well, that's by God. So that was an interesting thing for me. So here we see it says that he said this twice. I think it says he appeared to him a second time. But if you look over at 1 Chronicles 28, we don't have to go over there, but in 1 Chronicles 28, when David is restructuring the administration, David makes mention of this to Solomon. We see it in 1 Kings 3 that God talks to Solomon about it. You also see in 1 Kings 8, as far as this isn't being told to him, but Solomon, he makes mention of this, the idea of keeping the commandments, the ordinances, the statutes. 1 Kings 8:58, it says that he may incline our hearts to hear himself, to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, which he commanded our fathers. So you have at least, three different recordings before this where it's mentioned about keeping the statutes, the ordinances, and the commandments. Furthermore, you go back to Deuteronomy 17, you think about this, and I'm thinking about it from the standpoint of Solomon being the wisest man on earth, and how that doesn't necessarily matter when it comes to matters of the heart or what you choose to do. In Deuteronomy 17, this is, the context is 14 through 20, but this is, it says, when I will set a king over, when you say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations who are around me, then the king's supposed to do such and such and such. In verse 18, it says, now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. Now, why do I read all that? Why do I bring this up? It's because I'm not going easy on Solomon. In the context of what the writer put, it says that God appeared to him twice. But Solomon knew this stuff. God came to him and warned him. And you think about this, and I think we'll mention it in our next lesson as well. It wasn't just in the law that Moses wrote. And it wasn't just David talking to him. The Lord God Almighty appeared to Solomon twice. Told him these things twice. How important is it for you to be mindful of what the Lord is telling you? And the fact that if you'll do what I tell you to do, keep my statutes, keep my commandments, keep my ordinances, then your days will be prolonged. You will be blessed. That's been the theme of all this as we've talked about the kingdom and what the king should do. So God's, it's almost, not almost like God knew what was going to happen. God knows what's going to happen, but I'm going to remind you again and again, because he also talks about it in Deuteronomy, where there may come a time where you get joyful and your heart becomes merry and you'll turn away from me. Think that it was all of your own self-doing. You know, God's trying to remind him, humble him, remember, do these things and I will bless you. Your kingdom will thrive. Your days will be prolonged. And so we see that here in chapter 9. David and Solomon both implored God to keep and confirm his promises. Does God keep his promises both for salvation and for judgment? Yes. Yes, he does. Can y'all think of any examples? And I was looking for anywhere in the Bible of examples of the idea of God keeping his promise both for the good or for the bad. And that's a great one. I was trying to find something before here, because example Solomon could have known about. Judges is a great understanding of that. The idea of you had sin, suffering, supplication, and salvation. And you can look back in Deuteronomy 28 and talks about the things that God would put them through if they turned away from him and they didn't follow his statutes and commandments. It also talked about it in Deuteronomy. I'll look at Deuteronomy 31. In Deuteronomy 31. Deuteronomy 31:17, then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be consumed, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, is it not because our God is not among us that these evils have come upon us? But I will surely hide my face in the day because of the evil which they will do, for they will turn to other gods. And this is in the context of the Lord talking to Moses. He says, behold, you're about to lie down with your fathers, and these people will arise and play the harlot with strange gods of the land. We see that in Judges. We see that happening. This can also hearken to what's going on now in the kingdom of Israel.
What happened before the Judges also, in Joshua, and they were conquering the land,
the
battle of Ai. Don't do this.
You did this. Exactly. Lord, this is where I rely on your Bible knowledge too, because there's an overwhelming wealth of information to try to pick these things out, but you can pinpoint so many things that kind of stand out to you of, God made a promise. We think about the good things, the covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the covenant he made with David, the fact that it's fulfilled in Christ. You think about the covenants that he made, not only for the messianic, but for the kingdom. And if you keep these things, I will do them for you, especially with David. But you're thinking about the bad things. What are some other examples of promises that God made or warnings that he gave and he fulfilled them because the people weren't obedient? Genesis 3, sin, and then there's going to be death. Okay, what else?
Blood.
The flood. I mean, these are none of these I have. So this is great because I have some others. But yeah, the flood.
Still a promise today.
It is still a promise today. What else, Josh? So in that one, that's God told them that they would wander for 40 years and then the next generation would rise up. You know, that's that covenant too. He fulfilled his promise to them. He kept that promise to them that that would happen. What are some others? This is good stuff.
I'm sure you've uncovered the tearing away of the kingdom from Solomon, chapter 11.
Well, and that's kind of where I was thinking. It's not just that, but it's how it's fulfilled later on. I was thinking of what we're actually talking about. Thinking of 2 Kings 17, and I'm thinking of 1 Chronicles 36. The idea that what God is warning him about now, how it comes to fruition down the line. You know, the kingdom will eventually be divided. Israel will continue to play the harlot. And 2 Kings 17 says, because they've turned away from me in idolatry, and I've warned them over and over and over again. And so they're washed away. They're taken away. They're taken into captivity, never to return. And that would be by Assyria. Then you go to, you've got Judah left. You've got 2 Chronicles 36 where it talks about I sent you prophet after prophet after prophet. And so I'm going to, 70 years, you're going to be taken into captivity and you're going to be only a remnant coming back out. You think those, so God keeps his word for the good or for the bad. And that's what I find that interesting from the standpoint of I don't, maybe y'all do, but I don't really think about it from the standpoint of God keeping his word. It's like a parent. You're going to do what I tell you to do. I'm going to keep and hold fast to the promises that I make to my children. And then, but it's also going to be the punishments. It seems with parents, it's more punishment. Like you do this again and you're going to get it versus, the building up. Like I will always be there for you, those sort of things. But no, God keeps his promises regardless of whether it's for the good, the blessings, or for the bad, the judgments on people because they don't do what he's instructed them to do. Thoughts, questions, comments on that?
I found it interesting that Solomon had this pattern. And for 10 years, he said, one time, and then at the end of this, he talks to him again.
Mm-hmm.
Those years of building the temple, this palace, and all those years, he had the word to read and a pattern to go by. God didn't have to speak to him directly. And so many people say, God needs to talk to my heart, or God needs to
Mm-hmm.
In order to follow his word. But Solomon didn't have that, but God expected him to follow the pattern.
He did. And so we don't talk to God directly, but we have his inspired word here, written to us and in a written form for us from prophets. That's all that is required. Solomon got the extra when it was God speaking to him. And you think about that he didn't have to have that. He should have been able to be obedient regardless of God talking to him because of what was already talked about in Deuteronomy. But there's that much further, the fact that he was able to see God in a vision, that God talked to him, or see God in a dream, and then that God would talk to him. How much more? But then again, how often do people just throw that away? When God has come and spoken to them and they just... I think about the people of Israel. God was on Mount Sinai, and you think about how they experienced him in the different forms and fashions, and they experienced the miracles, and they experienced the plagues, and then they still turned away. Just think about that. What I'm getting at is, it doesn't matter if God's before you or not. It doesn't matter if God performs some actions or miracles in front of you or not. It's your choice to whether you're going to be obedient. It didn't have an impact on some of these people. It does have an impact on others, but we don't have to have that to be obedient to God and to heed his warnings and his words. How and where does God fulfill this promise of judgment? I've talked about that. I'll go ahead and... So, Israel, 2 Kings 17, and then Judah is in 2 Chronicles 36. So you've got Assyria, and then you've got Babylon, the Chaldeans. And I made mention here, so God used ungodly people to judge his people. Does that mean that he has now shifted his love or his blessing to those others? No, it's not the way that works. That's true. It doesn't mean you don't love them. And they were used as agents. You know, we can go back and see them and see. I think I have it in my notes somewhere. I think it was Jeremiah 50 or 51, where then it's the Chaldeans are going to be judged for what they did to Israel. It wasn't that he showed favor to the Chaldeans. It wasn't that he showed favor to the Assyrians. They were a tool to be used to punish Israel and Judah for what they'd done. And that's that's what it is. He continued to keep his promise. They were just agents in which this happened. So that's First Kings 9, 1 through 9. Any other comments or thoughts on that? So we move on. So now we're going to see. So after the temple's built, now we have this promise and warning to Solomon. And then we're going to kind of move into a little bit about his kingdom. And here, 11 through 14, it talks about Hiram. Hiram's who? King of Tyre, guy who helped build the temple. And so 10, it says that after 20 years, Solomon built two houses, and then he's gonna do something for Hiram. So how many cities did Solomon give Hiram, when and where? 20 cities in the land of Galilee, and it was in the 20th year of his reign. So whether that was 3 years after the temples were built, if that, you know, at what point in time, I don't know if there's a flash forward or back, but it seems like things have been completed, and then now Solomon gives these cities to Hiram. What was his response? I don't have it in here, but what was his response? He wasn't pleased. I looked into this, and I was just curious. Sometimes I overthink these things, but let's see. Yeah, verse 12, it says, so Hiram came out from Tyre to see the cities which Solomon had given him, and they did not please him. And he said, why are these cities which you have given, what are these cities which you have given me, my brother? So they were called the land of Kabul to this day. He may not have been pleased, and this rolling around in my head, so if anybody can illuminate me on this, I would be great, or it's just going to be one of those I don't know things. Hiram may not have been pleased with the cities in general. Like, that's kind of the, you know, the heel end of the loaf of bread. Like, I'm not really fond of that. Or these cities weren't what he was expecting. But the other thing could have been that Hiram was paid to do all this work. Also, Hiram had opportunity to help build the most majestic building ever built. The most glorious thing for the one true and living God. So if it didn't please him, maybe he was I didn't need it. I didn't want it. It didn't. Don't give me any more because I've already been compensated. And so I wondered about that. I couldn't find anything to indicate that was the case. But also, I wondered if it didn't please him. It didn't please him for that reason. You don't need to give me these things because not only have I been compensated, but you know I was able to build for the Lord this great majestic thing that stands. Anybody have any more information on that? I just found that was really interesting. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know. Yeah, he's like, what are these cities? But here's some money. You know, I don't understand that either. So it was just an interesting section here that I was wondering from both those perspectives.
Isn't there a mountain range right there on the western border, the northwestern, about Tyre? It could have been worthless land. Just dumped it.
Well, I don't know. It's true. It's worthless, and it could have been worthless, but I don't know. I'd like to think with Solomon being wise like he is, he wouldn't have just given him just the heel end of the piece of bread, like these cities that weren't worth anything. So.
That's a stretch, but it could be about the other point that you were making, which to me makes sense, whereas I've already been paid, I don't need this, you didn't need to give me this. Here's 120 talents of gold. Please let me pay you for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. It's just an interesting conundrum. things that roll around your mind as you're studying this. You know, there are so many times in here I've thought, well, why was this recorded? Why was this put in? And we may never know. But it's just interesting that that was a part of this account. Yes, sir. Yes, Rocky.
The consideration to Atlanta Capital, people were hired from Tyre. And that's on the coast. Very beautiful coast. They also have the forest of Lebanon there. The very majestic wooded area, lots of trees, and beautiful. It could have been a location to see the Galilee. There's nothing compared to what you had before.
Well, I mean, I can sympathize with that. You know, Texas is God's country, right? You go outside of Texas and everything else isn't really, it's worthless. I mean, sorry, Alex, and I know you like New York, but, you know, New York is like the bane of my existence for the busyness and the everybody on top of each other. But, you know, you think about that. That's good. That's a good point, Rocky. The fact that he just may not have been to his liking because of where he's from. We've spent too much time on that. Anyway, so moving on to 1 Kings 9, 15 through 28. So this has come up in class before, so as it came up again, I wanted to deal with it a little bit better since I didn't deal with it very well before, and to study it a little bit more. So I put in here, what is forced labor, and what does it mean to that he levied it? So we see this in this context. Let's see here. That would be verse 15. King Solomon levied a forced labor, and so what is forced labor? Did y'all come up with a definition or an idea? Okay.
Urgent, you can see, leaned in the idea of a draft.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's in character of the word, but
that's ready. So I went about it from the standpoint of looking at the Hebrew word, and just doesn't mean that this is indicative of what it is. I think context will really give us a good idea. But if you look at the Hebrew word, the word actually translates burden. That is a tax in the form of forced labor. When you look at that word levied, I looked it up in Strong's. But I also looked at the different versions of this, different versions that we have. And so King James reads, raised a levy out of all Israel, and the levy was 30,000 men. ESV says drafted forced labor out of Israel, and the draft numbered 30,000 men. The NIV says conscripted laborers from all Israel, 30,000 men. So the idea that, you know, you raised or you drafted, you conscripted, you know, that you're going to put a burden upon these men, you know, that's, you know, the idea that they are not slaves, but I think the best way to think about it is the way we do a draft nowadays, if you were to be drafted into the military for war.
In fact, in 2 Chronicles 8:8-9, it contrasts Solomon raising up the forced laborers versus the next verse, but did not make slaves of Israel. So it seems to me that they're the same. That you know, they're carried away to make the work. And so, and of course, he did not do that to the Israelites.
Yes, I think there's another question about that later. Couple down or the next one. So what did he use the forced labor to build? Let me get there first. No. What did he build first? We're going to go to what did he build first, and then we're going to go to who built it. So the temple, the palace, the wall of Jerusalem, the Milo, Hazar, Meadow, and Gezer. And then if I'm understanding this right, you go down a little further and it says, the storage cities which Solomon had, even the cities of his chariots and the cities of his horsemen, and all that it pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and all the land under his rule. So we have that list in verse 15, but it appears that maybe also in 19 that you can tie that in, that there are other things that they built as well. So they built a lot of stuff. Now here's where, Wally, here's where I was asking about who were the laborers. So who were the laborers?
The Hittites, the Perizzites, Havites, and Jebusites.
Yeah, so verse 20. And so verse 20, you have this, you not only have these the Israelites that are forced labor, but you also have these others. But like Linda had mentioned, verse 22, it says, "But Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel, for they were men of war, his servants, his princes, his captains, his chariot commanders, his horsemen." And there, you go back to Leviticus, they were not to make the sons of Israel slave labor. So you have this massive forced labor group that builds a bunch of stuff. And that'll actually, we may get to it in a second. It'll be in our next lesson to an extent. But that plays a part, I think, in some of what happens in 11 and 12. When was the Millo built? This is maybe a trick question based on... No, so I was actually thinking about more now, but you're right. That's why, I mean, it may be a trick question because, so the Millo, I got some notes from it. I've looked it up as well. Millo means fortress. It could mean citadel. There were indications that it might have been a tower. Here it says, verse 24, that then he built the Millo. That was after he built his house and Pharaoh's daughter's house. And so that was when the Millo was built. But it was more just we could talk about what the Millo is. It's a fortress, a citadel, maybe a tower. And like Elizabeth said, you see that first mentioned, I say first mentioned. There's definitely a reference that was 2 Samuel 5, where when David takes over Jerusalem, we see about the Millo, and he builds around there. And then you might see it in Judges, where it talks about some of that as well. But it seems like this was an existing structure that they continued to build up as Jerusalem's growing. You think about David took it over in 2 Samuel 5. Jerusalem is now the capital city. He builds his house. Now Solomon is growing it, adding on his extra part for his palace, for the for the trees of Lebanon, for the hall of pillars, the hall. And so you've got him adding there. Then you've got the wall and everything else. And so now he's building, fortifying, making it bigger. Just put that in there so we'd understand what that was. Where was Pharaoh's daughter staying before she was brought up, and why didn't Solomon let her stay? She was in the city of David. Do you have a more specific place where she was at? No. So this is, again, this is going to be that, you got to look at Chronicles when you're looking at Kings, because we're getting a little bit better idea of where she was at before. So 2 Chronicles 8:11 says, "Then Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city of David, like Todd said, to the house which he had built for her. For he said, 'My wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of the Israel, because the places are holy where the ark of the Lord has entered.'" He didn't want her staying in the house of David. He wanted to bring her up because of that reason. I thought that was interesting as well. She is his wife. He's built her a place, but he didn't want her staying there because he didn't want her staying where the places are holy, where the ark of the Lord had entered. I don't remember reading anywhere where the ark was in David's house, but obviously based on this, at least at some point in time, there was proximity there. Let's see. Questions, comments on that? What did Solomon build in Ezon-Geber? Fleet of ships. So this has been my experience with this, but as I studied this, you know, the vastness of what the kingdom of Israel was and how diverse it was. You think about, okay, this is in a rural area. I always think of, you know, sand desert, maybe a few oases. You know, you think of, you know, now Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Arab countries, stuff like that. You think of just a lot of sand and dirt and everything. And I don't think of them being a nation where they had ships. I don't think of it being as plentiful or flourishing like it was. Just like when you think of Egypt, you don't necessarily think of the deltas that they had and the things that they grew. Israel was a very diverse nation. With a fleet, with fleets of ships, and with a bunch of other aspects of their economic growth and being trade routes and stuff like that, and so That was just an aside from the standpoint of it's mentioned. These ships were built in the southern part of the kingdom near the Red Sea, and then they could take them out. There was a river that they could take out. And we see here, we'll see it, I think, in a few questions later, where there was a fleet of ships manned by Hiram's men, and then we see another fleet of ship outside of that, the ships of Tarshish. All right, moving into chapter 10. Why did the Queen of Sheba come to Jerusalem? Yes, so she heard about Solomon's fame and wisdom. Verse 1, she came to test him with difficult questions. So she'd heard about him. She'd heard, and it says, she heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord. So she came to test him with difficult questions. How did Solomon respond to her?
He answered all her questions.
He answered all her questions. Nothing, it says here, nothing was hidden from the king which he did not explain to her. So she'd come and ask whatever, and I don't know in what context what she would be asking about, but he basically showed her that the rumors were true. After perceiving all that is mentioned in verses 4 through 6, what did the queen say? So I'm going to read that and I'll get you to respond. When the queen of Sheba perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of his waiters and their attire, his cupbearers, his stairway by which he went up in the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. Then she said to the king, "It's a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom." So, what does the queen say? Verses 7 and following.
The half hadn't even been told.
The half hadn't even
been
told? Okay.
His wisdom
exceeded. Yeah, so exceeded her expectations. A little bit, you said he exceeded in wisdom and prosperity the reports I had heard. And that's where Linda had mentioned, behold, the half was not told to me. You've exceeded my expectations so much more on everything. It's just, it's hard to describe as I'm here. What else?
She said she didn't believe it until she saw it with her own eyes.
That's right. She didn't believe it until she saw it with her own eyes. Now she could go back and report. What else we have?
She acknowledges God.
And that's kind of what I was thinking. I'm going to go to verse 8 and then verse 9, but Josh, you're keying in on what I was thinking about. Verse 8, it says, "How blessed are your men who stand before you continually and hear your wisdom." You know, you think about, he's the smartest man alive. He's the most wise man alive. And you think about maybe being close proximity to somebody who's really wise and picking up on things, and how blessed they are to have that happen. But she, like Josh said, she focuses, verse 9, on how that happened. "Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you to set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness." And so I asked the question, who did the queen attribute all that she saw? To God. And we can go back to Deuteronomy. We may actually go back to Deuteronomy in a second, but you go back to Deuteronomy where it talks about, you know, the statutes, the ordinance, and the commands laid out for these people and their wisdom. But it's also so that people can see what God you have in close proximity to you, and what God would do this for you. She sees, and that's, again, we're not to a point yet where Solomon has turned from God. She sees in what Solomon has done, how he's ruled, what's going on, that the Lord is exalted. "Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you to set you on the throne." Solomon is not exalted. It's the Lord being exalted in that context. Yes, sir.
Sometimes when we study these lessons here, we're concentrating on the characters and the main events. The side truths that are really kind of very important. The end of verse 9 is a real critical one, in my view, about religious leaders. What does God expect?
Yes, I agree. I mean, we've been looking at Solomon, but she notices what kind of leader he is, that to do justice and righteousness, that should be the goal of the leadership, what we should pray for. It's, you know, it's something that doesn't always happen, and how great it is when the leadership is that way. I said we'd go to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 4. I was going to read that context here so I don't butcher it again. Deuteronomy 4:4, it says, "But you are held fast to, but you who hold fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. See, I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do thus in the land where you are entering to possess it." This is Moses talking to the people based on what God told him. "So keep and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.' For what great nation is there that has God has a God so near to it as the Lord our God whenever we call on him? Or what great nation is there that his statutes and his judgments are righteous as the whole law which I am setting before you?" Go down to verse 34 there. It's mentioned, I'll go to verse 33. "Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire as you have heard it and survived it? Or has a God tried to go to take for himself a nation from within other nations by trials, by signs, by wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown that you might know how the Lord, you might know that the Lord, he is God. There is no other besides him. Out of the heavens he lets you hear his voice to discipline you. And on earth he let you see his great fire, and you heard his words from the midst of the fire. Because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them. And he personally brought you from Egypt by his great power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you to bring you in and to give you their land for an inheritance as it is today. Know therefore today and take it to your heart, the Lord, he is God in heaven above, and on earth below, there is no other." I think about the Queen of Sheba when I'm reading that context. You know, the people should know that. But she comes and she sees and she knows, and the stories have been great. That's the whole purpose of all this, is that they would know that they're God's people. But then others would hear of what had happened, how they came out of Egypt. And she could come and say, I mean, the rumors are true. You are a great nation. What God you have. You know, what God, you know, you hear these things, but sometimes you may not believe them. They're so outlandish. But she knows, she believes now that what God you have that would do all these things for you, that would allow you to rule Solomon, that would give your people this, and how blessed that they are and how blessed that you are. What gifts did Solomon give to the queen?
All that she desired plus more.
All that she desired plus more. They're a very prosperous nation, and Solomon... and sent her on her way with, it says, his royal bounty and, all of her desire. How much was Solomon's income for the year, and where did it come from? $666 talents. Kind of where did that come from? Traders, merchants, kings, governments, yes. Taxes, that was one of the things I thought about. I'm not here, Susan's not here for me to give her a hard time, the idea of deputies versus governors and that sort of thing. But, and so you've got your taxes, you've got these traders, the wares from the merchants, the kings, and then it says then the governors of the country. That's where this income came from. Describe the throne of Solomon. Ivory overlaid with gold. How great was Solomon, and who sought his presence?
All the earth.
Verse 23. He became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom, and all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. What arrived once every 3 years, and what? Ships from Tarshish, and what did they bring? So gold, silver, ivory, apes, peacocks. Again, this has changed my view of what Israel was at its peak. You know, the idea that, you know, you're bringing not only just vast amounts of wealth, gold and silver. It says down a little further, it says that silver wasn't worth anything. Verse 27, the king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem. There's another a little further up where it says silver had no value or something along those lines in those days. You think about the nation, you know, these ships coming in, and I don't think of Israel having apes and peacocks and ivory. You think about ivory, stuff that's being imported maybe from Africa or something like that. Very wealthy and rich nation. Now, in my next lesson, I was rushing to kind of get through this so we can discuss it for a second. I don't really deal with this as much, but, you know, after Solomon dies and then Rehoboam becomes king, he's faced with a choice. And what was requested of him when he becomes king? This y'all may not know because y'all haven't studied it yet. Okay, lower the taxes. You know, lighten the burden. Okay, so you think about this. We've talked about forced labor a couple times. You think about all the work they've been doing. You know, think about what was said back in 1 Samuel 8. From the standpoint of the king's going to take and take and take and take. Well, you wanted a king, it comes with these things. And it doesn't list forced labor there, but the idea is that the king is going to rule over you, and he's going to tax you, and he's going to take your women, and he's going to take your children, he's going to take your servants. He's going to take and take and take. And now he's got this, it's 1 Kings 5 where he's got somebody, or 1 Kings 4 where he's got somebody over the forced laborers before you mention the temple. These people, you know, with the king, there comes this consequence. And the king had, you know, he was building and building and growing, but he had put a burden on the nation in that sense. And they wanted their load to be lightened. So this wealth has been grown, but it's been grown at a cost. And it's been at a cost of the people. Whether they see it or not, I don't think they do. But this is your choice. You wanted a king. This isn't the way he wanted his government to be established. He was king over them. They had rejected him. Excuse me. And so as this is kind of an underlying theme that'll pop up, and we'll divide the kingdom to an extent. You know, it didn't have to be divided, but this is a main point of contention. There's all this great stuff, but the people are constantly, you know, with this forced labor. And I don't know if it was in rotation or he just conscripted the people that he wanted and then they got to go back home. But this has been rough on them. And, you know, so great wealth comes with great cost, and that's, we can kind of see that as well.
Keith, you read Deuteronomy 17.
Yes.
That section at the end,
mm-hmm.
Right before that is where it says, "You shall not accumulate gold and silver, and you shall not multiply wives." And then we've got the end of chapter 10, followed by the beginning of chapter 11, him violating both those instructions.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that that's recorded there, and then that Solomon did those things. He accumulated personal wealth, but he accumulated wealth for the nation. God said he was going to bless him. He definitely shouldn't have accumulated wives. David did that too. Saul did that too. Why it was allowed to happen, I don't know. It doesn't seem at this point that there's any indication that God was upset with what Solomon had done. That's one of those things that it's interesting that's recorded in Deuteronomy 17, and then now we have what's going on over here. But I do know that, you know, consequences of your actions. You wanted a king. Here you go. And maybe that's a lesson to be learned. You know, don't ask for that because, you know, the king's going to have that rule and then your king is going to stray a little bit. And we're going to see as we move into 11 how Solomon allowed himself to be turned away from God after having all these blessings, both material, physical, mental blessings that he had received from God. All right. To an extent, I agree. I do. 24 in the back.